Sai. I hope you had a nice weekend, and I saw some of you at the Blues Festival, so that's great. Okay, so what I would like to do this week is I would like to start discussing Hamiltonian mechanics. And first, I will do the basic theory, you know, not using any fancy differential geometry notation. So something you should already be familiar with. And I will also discuss in this notation some more advanced topics, like Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And then towards the end, I will show you that whatever we have done has this beautiful description in terms of the symplectic geometry, this fancy, fancy notation. So today should be mostly review, I hope, although I will tell you some confusing statements towards the end of the lecture. The statements are true. They are not, in that sense, they are not confusing, but they will be derived in Landau's way. So they will be derived in this very, very intuitive physical way, which is not 100% rigorous, but the result is true. So anyway, so let me start with Hamilton's canonical equation. So part A, Hamilton's canonical equations. And so when Hamilton formulated them, he was in 1834, he was only 29 years old. And 29 years old. Okay, so basically what I will do is that I will proceed from the Lagrangian description to the Hamiltonian one. Of course, this may not always be straightforward, and you may not be able to go freely from one description to the other because there are some obstacles, but let's assume that these obstacles are not here at this point, and everything is nice. So the first step is to define canonical momentum. So canonical momentum is simply if you are given the Lagrangian, you just define P I, which is dl over d q dot I. So that's a definition of a new quantity. Okay. And so now what we want to do is we really want to proceed from the description, from the Lagrangian descriptions, which uses q and q dot, to the Hamiltonian description, which uses q and p, this canonical momentum, instead of q dot. Okay, so now I mentioned that already on Friday that we can have a configuration space and we can have a phase space. So configuration space is simply a photo of the system. So configuration space is something like a photo of the system. And it uses local coordinates just qj, or qy. And so there is n of those if you have n degrees of freedom. So this would be your what I call the tangent the manifold M. So you associated the configuration space with the manifold M. OK, so now we introduce the velocity phase space, which had q and q dot coordinates on it, and that described already a state, the true state of the system. So now in the Hamiltonian description, the phase space is the momentum phase space, so we'll have q and p. So versus phase space, and that describes physical states, describes physical states, and the coordinates would be qi and pj. So we have 2n coordinates, and it's a 2n dimensional space if you have n degrees of freedom in the system. So now, if we had the velocity phase space, so we have q and q dot. Q dot is a vector. So the velocity phase space is a tangent bundle over the configuration space. It's a tangent bundle over the manifold. However, here you see that p has an index down rather than up. So it's actually a form. So what this phase space is a cotangent bundle over the configuration space.
both have indices alpha, it'd be a tangent product.
I'm saying if you had the velocity phase space, as in the Lagrangian description, in the geometric description, so if you had velocity phase space, then your local coordinates would be just qi and then dqi over dt, or qi dot. And so I'm saying that, well, whereas this is a vector, the velocity is a vector, the momentum is actually a form. Okay, so they have this dual description. So this guy has an index up, this guy has an index down, and so they live in different space. So this would be a tangent bundle. Okay, so, okay, I didn't say anything. Let's keep it here. It's true, but it's gonna, yeah, we don't need it. So anyway, so we have a phase space where the motion occurs, and it really describes the physical state of the system. And so you want to define a function on the phase space which determines your dynamics. Okay. So in the same way as the Lagrangian was the right thing on the velocity phase space, so it will be the Hamiltonian which governs the dynamics in the momentum phase space. So Hamiltonian. Governs the dynamics and so again I'll assume that I can start with the Lagrangian, and in that case the Hamiltonian, which is a function of qi pj and t, so it's a function of these coordinates on the phase space, it's given by pi qi dot minus L, where L is my original Lagrangian. But of course, if you look at this, then L is a function of Q and Q dot, but the left-hand side is a function of Q and P. So what you have to do in the end is that you have to basically plug everywhere where you see Q dot. You have to evaluate that as a function of Q, P, and T. Okay, so that's the prescription. And so that the last relation is exactly this thing here. So you see that P is defined of in terms of some function. It's a function of Q and Q dot and T. So if I can invert this relation, I can write what Q dot is as a function of Q and P. And then I can plug it here. Okay. So of course, this inversion may not always be possible. And we will discuss some examples in two lectures' time when this is actually not possible, and you have some constraints typically in the system and stuff like that, and then you may have problems going from one description to the other. But let's assume now this is all well defined. You can do that. You can find the inversion. Then you plug the inversion here into this prescription, and you have the Hamiltonian. Okay. So now the beautiful theorem is that basically you can turn n second-order Euler Lagrange equations for your dynamics to 2n first-order Hamilton's equations. So intuitively, this should be sort of equivalent, but I think it's nice that you can really write it as a first-order system. So theorem due to Hamilton, the system of n Euler Lagrange equations is equivalent to the system of twice as many, but now first order Hamilton's equations and so these equations are written as follows. So you have P J dot is now there's always one minus sign and the other one has plus sign, and I never know which one is which. So anyway, so is this thing here is correct. So you differentiate the Hamiltonian partially with respect to Q, and that gives your P dot. And then the second equation is that QI dot now is plus is dH over dPi. Okay, so that's the theorem. And so these are the new equations which we work with. And they are only first order equations, of course, for P and Q. Okay, so how to show this? So one way, for example, would be I really have my definition of the Hamiltonian, which is given here. And then I painfully differentiate. So I have to differentiate that function with respect to P. I have to use the Euler-Lagrange equations somewhere. And then I get whatever is on the left side. OK, so that's the painful way. Let's do the nice way, which is, again, the variational principle. So proof would be through variational principle. So we still are using the principle of the least action. So our action is stationary. So we know that zero, that the motion is such that this is true. So of course, this is nothing else than delta of L dt. But now my L, if I use the defining relation for the Hamiltonian, is just pq dot minus h. Okay. So this is delta of integral, and then pi qi dot minus h dt. Okay, and so now I have to do the variation. And the trick is that now you have sort of two n variables. And of course, the variable p and q are independent. So you'll be varying p and q independent. And then you require that the true trajectory is such that whatever the p delta p is and whatever the delta q is, the action must be stationary inside. Okay, so let's do the variation. So we have several terms. So we have an integral. Now we'll have qi dot delta pi. Now we have the other term, which is pi delta qi dot. So that's the first one, minus dh. And h depends on p and q. So dh over dpi delta pi minus dh over dqi delta qi, and then dt. OK, so remember, again, the time is fixed. During this variation, it's exactly the same variation as before. So that's why we are not having dh over dt thing here. So now, again, this is the standard variation as we know it. So you can swap delta with the time derivative. Okay, so this thing is just d over dt of delta qi. And you can integrate by parts. And so if you do that, first you pick up the boundary term, which will be pi delta qi at t1 and t2. So pi delta qi from t1 to t2. That's your boundary term. And then let me connect whatever stands by the variation delta pi. So it'll be this term minus that term. So it's plus t1 to t2. And then I have qi dot from here minus dh over the pi. Delta pi. So it's this term plus that term. And then I will have this term plus that term, delta qi. And of course, if I differentiate by parts, I pick up a derivative here. So it's minus pi plus dh over dqi delta qi. And the whole thing is, of course, multiplied by dt. Sorry for this mess there. So this is still integral dt. Pi dot, yeah, thank you. OK, so as previously, we have the fixed endpoints. So delta qi at t1 and delta qi at t2 is, of course, equal to 0. So this is fixed endpoints. And then you require that this is 0 for any delta pi and any delta qi. That means that this guy has to be 0, and that guy has to be 0 as well. And if you look at these conditions, they are precisely the Hamilton's equations. OK, so this is basically doing this exactly the same proof as you do for variation of Euler-Lagrange equations. The only difference is that you now treat p and q as independent quantities, and that's why you get two contributing terms. Everything is very simple. OK, very good. So that's the proof. No questions? No questions. So just a remark. Hamiltonian, as defined over here, is typically an integral of motion. And so how we can see that, so if you calculate what is dh over dt, so then, of course, you have dh over dq and then q dot plus dh over dp and then p dot. Plus, if there is an explicit dependence of h on t, then of course that screws things up. So anyway, so now you can plug whatever the q dot is in terms of the Hamilton's equation. So if you impose the equations of motion, then this is equal to dh over dq, and then q dot is dh over dp, and then plus dh over dp. And then p dot is minus dh over dq plus whatever I had before. And so now if you look at the two terms here, they exactly cancel. They are precisely this term is exactly the same as that term. And so you get that it's really just equals dh over dt. So in other words, if h is not explicit function of time, then h is a conserved energy. So it's an integral of motion which has an interpretation of the energy. So dh over dt would be 0. So that's nice. So this quantity h is typically related to some conserved quantity. And this is basically the only conserved quantity which you have, which you are guaranteed to have for dynamical systems. So only few integrable systems admit additional conserved quantities apart from the energy. OK? No questions? So now, of course, what that transformation going from L to H is, it's nothing else than the Legendre transformation. And so by doing this Legendre transformation, you have to actually assign a scalar function on the tangent bundle, a scalar function on the cotangent bundle. So it's some, you know, some interesting map which maps, it basically turns your velocities into the momenta. And so that means that your scalars now live in a different space. OK, so it's a, if you want, it's a transformation from Tm, well, from a function living on Tm to a function living on T star of M. And we'll discuss that a little bit later. But OK, so it's an interesting transformation. So now what I want to do is that I want to show you this magic square. So of course, you are familiar with Legendre transformations, not only in terms of the classical mechanics, but also in case of the thermodynamics. And there it's more interesting because you have more variables, and you can do Legendre transformation with respect to many more variables. So let me just do this magic square. Probably have seen that. Or maybe you don't need it, and you just remember everything by heart. But typically, the traditional quantities in thermodynamics are the volume, the temperature, the pressure, and the entropy. Okay, so now to each of the pair of these two variables, you can assign the corresponding thermodynamic potential. So you can assign the internal energy. You can assign the free energy, the Gibbs free energy, and the enthalpy. Okay, and then there wouldn't be any magic if there were no arrows. So because you have arrows, that's the true magic. So you have one arrow going here, and then the other arrow going here. And you can think about that as a field line going from plus to minus. So there'll be minus here, and there'll be plus here. So if you have like field lines always go from plus charge to minus charge. So anyway, so now the statement is that basically this magic square contains all you need to know about thermodynamics. So in particular, there are like at least three properties hiding, three useful things which you can read from this square. So the first one is really the thermodynamic potentials. You'll discuss them a little bit more in the statistical physics course, but of course, you know approximately what they are. You know what internal energy is. And so these thermodynamic potentials, they are really, really nice quantities because they get extremized in equilibrium, but only provided that you have the right variables. So in other words, these thermodynamic potentials are total differentials if they are expressed in terms of their variables. So thermodynamic potentials are total differentials in terms, and they are expressed in terms of their variables. So what I mean by that is, so for example, you look at the internal energy here. So now I'm saying this will be a total differential. So you'll have something like du. When this is expressed in terms of the entropy and in terms of the v. So u is a function of entropy and v. And then, of course, what stands by the differential of ds, for example, is the corresponding conjugate quantity t. Okay, and then you can read the sign over here. So whatever the sign you see here is the corresponding thing. So you'll have, for example, plus. So it's plus t ds. And then there is a minus p dv. Okay, so this is the relation you are after. And so obviously, u is a function of s and v. So now why is this useful? Of course, if you keep the volume fixed and the entropy fixed, you know that du is equal to 0. So that means that actually u is either maximized or minimized or whatever. So it's extremized u. And so that's a useful property to calculate things. Okay. Very good. So that's the first thing. So you can read from here. Of course, you read immediately that g is a function. So another example would be that g is a function of t and p. And if you want the differential, you would have that dg equals to, now it's a plus vdp, and it's a minus sdt. Okay, and so this is how you use it. Simple. Okay, so you don't have to remember anything. You don't have to look up the Wikipedia. You can just read it from the magic square. Okay, so second thing is really how you do the Legendre transformation. Legendre transform. So these thermodynamic potentials are related by the Legendre transformation. So for example, the free energy is related to the internal energy by the Legendre transformation. And so what you have to do is basically you have to change the variable internal variable S to the internal variable T. Okay? And then again, you can read the sign. And so the sign is if you go from S to T, you get a minus sign. So for example, the free energy is the internal energy here, and then I'm going from S to T with a minus sign. Minus T and S. And because this guy is a total differential, you see what the T is. So T is nothing else than du over ds. Okay, so this is how you do the Legendre transformation, for example, from the internal energy to that. So really, you see, I have to change the variable S to T, and I read the minus sign. If you go from free energy to Gibbs free energy, you have to change V to P, and it's a plus sign.
But is there any mathematical formulation where you also see that Legendre transform in the thermodynamics as a diffeomorphism between tangent bundle and tangent bundle?
Well, it's more. Well, you have more variables, so it's a good question. Yeah, how would you do that? Certainly, people try to do that, and I can give you references where you can read about it. But yeah, we have more variables. So, So now if you look at this thing, of course, it's precisely as L is related to H, right? So if this guy is L, then you would have PQ dot. And this is precisely how you define the canonical momentum P. So this is precisely the Legendre transformation as we have it over there. But of course, now I can go with more variables. And, OK, so finally, the last thing, which is also very extremely useful in thermodynamics, which you can immediately read from this magic square, is the Maxwell relations. Maxwell's relations. And so basically, whatever you see on the opposite sides, it's true. So if you want to differentiate dV over dS at constant P, it's the same thing as differentiating dT over dP at constant S. Okay? Apart from a sign, which is possible there. So what I'm saying is basically this. So d of that divided by d of that at constant this guy equals to this. So it's d of that at constant this guy. So for example, dv over ds at constant p is dt over dp at constant s. Okay, and so now there may be a sign thing. So you see again there's a plus sign here. So where the constant thing is, there you read the sign. So it's plus and plus, so that's why there's plus. So sign you read here. And so that's why it's plus and plus. Okay? So similarly, I could do, you know, this triangle, for example, and that triangle. So I would have something like dv over dt, dv over dt at constant p. And that would be with a plus sign. And then this must be equal to ds over dp at constant t. And that's with a minus sign, so there will be a minus sign here. Okay. Of course, how you arrive at these Maxwell relations is that you just play with the form of the total differential. So for example, in order to derive the first one, I would have to realize that dH, so proof of the first one, so dH is a function of S and P, and with plus and plus, so it's equal to T dS plus dDP, okay? So that's the form of the total differential for the enthalpy. So in other words, dH over dS is equal to T, and dH over dP is equal to V. That's what you read from the differential. So now you can differentiate these things with respect to P and S respectively. So now d squared dP dS is dT over dP. Okay, and this must be equal to, if I swap the derivatives, so d squared h ds dp, which is dv over ds, and precisely the first Maxwell relation here. So basically, you get these Maxwell's relations by saying, well, I consider the corresponding thermodynamic potential, I write what it means, and then I use the integrability of these relations. And the integrability is that if I can swap the partial derivatives, then you can find h. And by swapping the partial derivatives, you are getting the Maxwell relation this equals to that. Okay. So anyway, so I just wanted to show you this magic square. And then that's all you need to know about the thermodynamics, basically. Well, not entirely, but almost. But for calculation purposes, that's all you need to know. Okay, so you can play with it if you want, but it contains all the information. Are there any questions? Okay, so that's an example of other theories which use the Legendre transformation. So now, let me start part B, which is quite interesting subject of Poisson brackets. So let me write a definition. So for two phase space functions, functions f and g, you define, so they're canonical Poisson bracket is a new function, is a new phase space function, defined by the following. So you put these curly brackets here, f and g, and that's how a Poisson bracket looks like. And then you differentiate the first one with respect to q, and then you differentiate the second one with respect to p, and then minus, and the other way around, so df over dpi, and dg over dqi. Okay, so this is the definition of the Poisson bracket. So you take two functions, you do some differentiation of these functions, so in the end you have a new function on the phase space, and that's given by this Poisson bracket here. So sometimes people choose different sign convention, so maybe that will be the other way around. I like this sign convention. As long as you are consistent, it doesn't matter. Okay. So that's a definition. So now Poisson brackets have many nice properties. So properties. So who has not seen Boston brackets before? Ah, very good. So something new. Ah, very good. So that's good. Just the definition. So now the first property will be, you know, how the fundamental brackets look like. So that what I mean by fundamental brackets is that if I just use f to be, let's say, my coordinate q and g to be my coordinate p. So then you are asking, for example, OK, let me start with q and q. So for example, qi and qj. So if you plug it into the definition, what are you getting? So from those who haven't seen? Zero. Very good. So if you take q and q, because one of them would have to be differentiated with respect to p, you are getting zero. So now if I take p and p, OK, so the same thing. So pi and then pj. This will be equal to zero as well. But now if I take qi and pj, then, so by the way, here I am summing over I again, right? So there's an Einstein summation convention here. So if it happens that I have the same I as j, I am actually getting equal to 1. And if it's not the same, then I'm getting equal to 0. Okay, so this is equal to delta ij. Okay, so these are the fundamental brackets. And of course, if you do quantum mechanics and you proceed from the classical one to the quantum, which of course cannot be done, but people do it anyway. So then all you do is that you promote that these brackets are not Boston brackets, but they are commutators. And so Q and, well, whatever. Okay, so quantum theory is typically derived by going from this to the commutation of the two operators. And then you add somewhere h bar. So in particular, you would have qi pj equals to I h bar delta ij. And then the other ones will be 0. So why? So this is a typical canonical quantization, if you want. Of course, it's wrong, right? So you cannot derive more fundamental theory from less fundamental one. Okay, so all you can do is that you can go, if you know what the true quantum theory is, you can take a classical limit, and you can derive classical mechanics, or you can derive corresponding classical theory, right? But you cannot go the other way around, right? The other way around is sort of guessing, or there's some, you know, some heuristic rules why it can work, but of course in general it doesn't work. So typically you should be going the other way around, from quantum theory to the classical one. Okay, so anyway, so this is why these fundamental brackets are useful. So another property is that, obviously by definition, if I swap f and g, I'll pick up a minus sign. So the other property is antisymmetry. Obvious from the definition. So f and g is minus g and f. Linearity. So if I take alpha times f, beta times g, and do a Poisson bracket with h, it's just alpha times f and h, and beta times g and h. And this is true for alpha, beta are real numbers. And f and g and h are functions. So the bracket is antisymmetric. It's linear. It obeys the Leibniz rule. So it is a derivative, if you want. or property 4 is Leibniz. So if you have product of two scalar functions, then it's just you don't differentiate the first one and do gh, and then you differentiate the first one, so f and h, and you put a g here. And finally, a miraculous property is the Jacobi identity. And so if you cyclically go around with three functions and you have two brackets, then you get a zero. So what it is that you take f, g, Poisson bracket, and then you make a new Poisson bracket with h, and then you cyclically go around with these functions and add all these three terms. So it's plus, now I'll have h and f and g, and then I will have g, h, and f. G, h, and f, and this is equal to 0. Okay, so that's the Jacobi identity. Something nice to have. Sort of tells you, you know, how you close these things or whatever. So now I told you this canonical definition. I told you explicit expression how you find the Poisson bracket as, in terms of the derivative with respect to Q and P. And then you can immediately check all these properties here just using the definition. However, you can as well use these things as a starting point, as a definition, and you would basically be able to show that the canonical bracket has to look like that. Okay, so you can take these as well as a definition. By the way, the properties 1 to 5 means that the Poisson brackets form like a Lie algebra or something like that. So you probably recognize these properties. Okay. So now, of course, people are asking interesting things, and you will do that in your tutorial today, is that, you know, once I impose all these fundamental properties, for example, the fundamental brackets plus all these linearity and stuff like that, then it's sort of equivalent to mechanics, to mechanical system. So now Feynman in 40s, actually, he was interested, well, are there some more interesting theories which you can discover by playing with Poisson brackets? And so he was basically relaxing some of these assumptions here, or some of the properties of Poisson brackets. In particular, he actually relaxed some of the fundamental brackets. And he said, you know, I don't require, for example, that P and P is equal to 0. Okay? So what happens then? And so you will see, and you will derive in your tutorial, then you automatically sort of get something like an electromagnetism. Okay? And then people try to generalize this to gravity, and people try to generalize. It's all like playing with nothing, but in the end, I think it's quite interesting. But he was really, really disappointed that he basically only got electromagnetism, no new theory, which he was after. And so he never published the paper, right? So he just, you know, showed it to Dyson, and then Dyson published it 30 years ago. 30 years after, after Feynman. So just, you know, to show physicists that Feynman was on this track. And so, and since then, you know, the paper got thousands of citations and stuff like that. Okay, so you will do that problem in your tutorial. So really, what happens if I relax some of the properties? Do I get some interesting, more interesting theory? Okay. So that's the properties. So now, another nice thing is that if you are interested in the time evolution of any function, then I wonder if the calculation is still here. It's not. OK, let me do it again. So of course, what this is df over dq, q dot, plus df over dp, p dot, plus df over dt. But if I use the canonical equations again, so it's precisely as I was doing before for h. So now this is df over dq. But instead of q dot, I write minus plus dh over dp, and then plus df over dp, and then p dot is minus dh over dq, and then plus df over dt. So now, if you look at these expressions here, then you immediately notice that this term minus, well, plus that term is precisely the Poisson bracket of f and h. Okay, so this is nothing else than, if I use the definition of the canonical bracket, it's f and h plus df over dt. So you have a beautiful, beautiful description. So your time evolution of any function is given by a Poisson bracket, plus possibly if the function depends explicitly on time, there's this explicit differentiation with respect to time. So this is df over dt, very nice relation. So now you remember when we defined the integrals of motion, was something which was defined by di over dt equals to 0. But typically, the integral of motion cannot be explicitly time dependent. So assuming that di over dt partial is equal to 0, you can sort of write this as ih equal to 0. So typically, in the Hamiltonian mechanics, you would say you have an integral of motion if the Poisson bracket is h equals to 0. Okay, so this is how you would define an integral of motion, something that Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so now what is a nice property which you will show in your tutorial today is that if you have, so property, if you have one integral of motion and another one, and you make the Poisson bracket, you get a new quantity. I3 is a new integral of motion. Now let me put new in commas here. So typically you get 0, which is of course an automatic integral of motion. But so the statement is that the Poisson bracket of the integrals of motion is guaranteed to have time derivative equal to 0. So the I3 over dt, the total derivative, will be equal to 0. And sometimes you can use this to generate new integrals of motion. Typically, it terminates at some point, and all you get is a 0. But for some systems, you can get new integrals of motion. And you will show this statement in your tutorial today. Okay? How much time I have? That's good. Are there any questions to Poisson brackets? I think it's a really, you know, beautiful structure. And as I said, by playing with Poisson brackets, you can even sort of arrive at electromagnetic theory, or you can add special relativity, and people try to add gravity as well, although not very successfully. You can also directly transit to quantum theory if you want. Okay, very good. So now let me discuss some interesting concept in Hamiltonian mechanics, which, you know, sort of shows you that Hamiltonian mechanics is very, very powerful. And the reason for that is that there is this huge freedom in the choice of coordinates you can describe your system. So you can choose different types of coordinates. And sometimes the description can be very, very difficult in those coordinates. But then you come with an ingenious change of coordinates, and suddenly you are able to solve the problem completely. Okay, and so that's encoded in special coordinate transformations, which are called canonical transformations. I'm gonna call. So I'll define them in a very practical way. So I'll say that a canonical transformation, canonical transformation. So I start with some old coordinates, small q and small p, and then I do go to new coordinates, big, well, capital Q and capital P. So I'll define new qj, which is, of course, a function of the old ones. And then new pj, and so this would be any coordinate transformation, of course. So now I impose some restriction on this transformation, and I'll say very, very vague restriction. So I'll say that a canonical transformation of this type is such transformation of this type, so that it preserves the form of Hamilton's equations. So, in other words, you can find that is, we can find new Hamiltonian H prime, which is a function of new coordinates of QJ, PK, and T, such that we have precisely the same form of the Hamilton's equation. So DH prime over DPJ is QJ dot, and DH prime over DQJ is minus PJ dot, is equivalent to the original equations. Still describes the dynamics, Okay, so there is some very, very strange restriction, right? So I don't allow any transformation of coordinates, Q and P, but I only allow such transformations I can find a new Hamiltonian so that the dynamics of the system can be written in this form, in the standard form. Okay? So now, stupid example that not every transformation is canonical. By this definition, you will see that in the geometric description, this will be much nicer. But anyway, so let me just do it without this geometry first. Okay. So example, not every transformation is canonical. So for example, you may be thinking I have a motion of a free particle. So let's consider a free particle. And so I specify my Hamiltonian to be just p square over 2m, where m is the mass of the particle, it's one-dimensional motion. So I have just p square. And then you may be naively thinking, well, let's do a coordinate transformation. I don't want, well, okay, such that the new Q is just square root of the old Q, so there's no Q in the Hamiltonian, but doesn't matter. And then the new P is just old P. So the question is this canonical? Okay. So now I am not really giving you a proof, but you can sort of guess. And then you will see later that it would have to be so, that the new Hamiltonian would simply look like, so guess that the new Hamiltonian H prime would be just the old one, but now expressed in terms of the new P. Okay, so you can then later show that this is the only possibility you could actually have. But anyway, so let's guess that this is my new Hamiltonian. So then you require that dh prime over dp is equal to q dot. This is what you require in order that transformation to be canonical. Require. However, what is this? So if you differentiate h prime with respect to p, well, you get just 2p over 2m, so it's just p over m. P over m, which of course is nothing else than small p over m. And this is nothing else than the old Hamiltonian over dp. But the original canonical equations told us that this must be equal to q dot. So that's the original thing which was valid for this system. But q dot, well, q is nothing else than capital Q square. So this is equal to 2q q dot. Okay. And now you obviously see is that q dot is not equal to 2q q dot unless q is equal to 1/2, which wouldn't be a very nice coordinate. So you see that this doesn't work. Okay, so in other words, not every transformation you can think of is a canonical transformation. And this is a really stupid example, but yeah, by this definition you can see that not everyone is that. Okay, so then the question, of course, is how do you find canonical transformations? How do you find such transformations which are useful but still satisfy the definition of being a canonical transformation. And so question is how to find canonical transformations and the statement is that they are generated by generating functions so now generating function has always the type, so I have some function which is a function of the old coordinate and the new one, and possibly t. So what is old? Old is q and p. And what is new is capital Q and capital P. Okay. So now what you have to do is that you have to choose always one out of the old ones, and you have to choose always one of the new ones. So obviously you have four possibilities. I can choose, for example, small q and big Q, or small q and big P, and whatever. So you have four possibilities. So four possibilities. So now, if you study simple systems, these may not be equivalent because some of the possibilities are, well, because you have some degeneracies. So if you have simple Hamiltonians, it's very likely that you will have some kind of extra symmetries or some kind of degeneracy in the description. So not all these four possibilities are equivalent. However, if you have generic Hamiltonian, they will be all equivalent, and they are related by Legendre transformation. So related by Legendre transformation. So let me assume that there is no degeneracy, so whatever, and that I can really choose any of these four possibilities. So let me choose the simplest one. Let me choose small q and big q. And then, you know, if you want, you can do at home similar calculation if you choose other possibilities. And then you can show that the result is sort of Legendre transform equivalent. Okay, so as an example, consider f, which is a function of small q, big q, t, and then I'll use the fact which you already know that in Lagrangian description, basically I have that freedom of adding a total derivative of a function to my Lagrangian, and I get the same equations of motion. Okay, then the freedom in the description, so I can describe the action in terms of the Hamiltonian PQ dot. Well, so this is my Lagrangian, PQ dot minus H. And then I'll add or subtract to this the total derivative of this function, dt. Okay, so and then this will have the same equations of motion as if I just use this thing here. Okay, it may change the boundary conditions, but the equations of motion will be the same. Okay, so that's the freedom I have, so that my equations of motion remain the same. Okay, so now what is this? So this is an integral. And so df over dt, but now f depends on small q, big q, and t. So I'll have df over dq, q dot, and then df over d big q and q dot. So this is pq dot minus h minus df over dq, q dot, minus df over d big q, q dot. And then I'll have also minus df over dt, and then dt. So now what you want is that this rewrites in the form of exactly the same thing as here, but now in terms of the new coordinates. So now you require, you want that this equals to p q dot minus h prime dt. So this is what you want. Okay, so let's compare the two things. So I'm writing this. I want to collect all the terms with q dot. So I'll have q dot here. And then, so the only thing which has q dot in it is this term here. And so by what stands by it is minus df over dq. Okay. Then I can collect the terms with small q dot. So plus small q dot, and I'll have p, and then minus df over dq. And then I'll have minus h, and then plus df over dt. Okay. So this I just rewritten whatever was written there. So now you see, so this is what I have, and this is what I want to have. So you see that this will be only true if big P is equal to minus df over dq. So this must be big P. This thing has to vanish because I don't want to have q dot sometimes something. So small p is equal to df over dq. And my new Hamiltonian is just the old one plus df over dt. OK, so these are the requirements. And so obviously, you can solve these equations if you want for the function f, and it will give you the generating function of the canonical transformation from small q and small p to large q and large p. Okay, and it also tells you how the new Hamiltonian has to look like. Okay. Or if you are given a transformation, well, okay. So you can read some integrability conditions from here again. So for example, in order my canonical transformation to be generated by function f, again, if I take another derivative with respect to big Q, and derivative with respect to small q, they must be equal. So then I am immediately getting an integrability condition that d big p over d small q must be equal to something like d small p over d big q or whatever. So that would be the integrability condition for this. But basically, the statement is if I have any function f, then this is the way how you find new p, and this is the way how you find new big p. And then your transformation generated by this function is guaranteed to be canonical. Okay, so you can really use this so the statement is every canonical transformation you can find the corresponding generating function. For simple systems, it may not be the one which is dependent on small q and big q, but it may be the one, for example, small q and big p or whatever. Okay. But for generic systems, it will be all equivalent. Okay, I don't have much time, so let me just write some obvious statements. So a few remarks. So first remark would be that Poisson brackets don't care about which coordinates you use, so are invariant with respect to canonical transformations. So in other words, you can actually calculate the Poisson bracket in terms of the original small q and p. And the statement is that this will be the same as if you use new coordinates q and p. And g, q and p. So now the simplest way of how to see this is that you just realize that the Poisson bracket, well, if I don't have this term, forget about that term. It's typically not there. For autonomous Hamiltonian systems, nothing depends explicitly on time, so you would have this. Okay. So then this thing really describes how the function f changes in time, how it changes in the time evolution. Okay. So now, of course, the time evolution of the function cannot depend on which coordinates you are using. Right? So it must be something which is invariant, which doesn't depend on the coordinates you are using. So think about this as, so you can think about this that G is some kind of Hamiltonian. And then what this describes is something like a df over dt generated by this function G. Okay, so that's the proof which Landau uses. I think it's physical and intuitive. It's almost correct. Okay, so doesn't depend on the choice of coordinates. So now Another statement is that the transformation is really canonical. It's canonical, and you can use it as check whether whatever you have written down is a canonical transformation, if again it satisfies the fundamental brackets are right. So, if and only if fundamental brackets look like they should look like, that means that Q I and then P j is equal to delta I j, and then Q and P R P are equal to zero. So in terms of, okay, so this is, so I write new coordinates Q and P, and if this is satisfied, then your transformation was indeed canonical. Okay, and it's really, really related to the fact that you have the same form of Hamilton's equations. Okay, so of course now you can write this in terms of any coordinates. So in terms of big Q and big P, this is trivial. But in terms of small q and small p, and using that they must be equal, this is a non-trivial condition. So really, it gives you some kind of differential equation which has to be satisfied. So you have dq over d small q and dp over d small p and whatever. So that's some consistency condition, which is a differential equation. And you can check, is this equation satisfied or not? OK. So finally, I would like to mention this beautiful result, which I'll prove next time, because we don't have time to do that. But you may be thinking about time evolution as something really nice and physical. But what I will try to show to you is that you can equally think about time evolution as simply a change of coordinates, as simply a canonical transformation. So if you evolve in time, this is completely equivalent to just changing coordinates. And so you can get rid of the time evolution by a convenient canonical transformation. OK, so the statement is the following. So third time evolution of the system in the phase space. So time evolution is a canonical transformation. Canonical transformation. Okay. And so you may be asking, what is the corresponding generating function which generates this time evolution? And so you may have some guess. So what is the guess? Very good, almost. So the Hamiltonian really generates the time evolution, but it's not the generating function. Okay, so the generating function of the canonical transformation, if you want. So Hamiltonian generates time evolution, but what really is the generating function for this? So it's generated by the generating function, which is given by the letter S. As always in theoretical mechanics, everything is written as S. Okay, so we have seen that S is an action, and this is almost an action. This is actually an action evaluated on the corresponding trajectory. So this is called Hamilton's function. And what it is an action evaluated. So you know that the action is an integral from t1 to t2 of something, L dt. So now what you have to do is that you take that Lagrangian, you write down the Euler Lagrange equations, you solve them. You have the solution, how q looks like, in terms of the initial data, in terms of the t1, t2, q1, and q2. Okay. So now you plug it back, and you integrate it. Okay. So then you get something which depends on t1, t2, q1, and q2. So on a trajectory. And this is what the Hamilton function is. Once you know the Hamilton function, you know everything about the system. Okay. So and this Hamilton function S is precisely what generates this canonical transformation, which equals to the time evolution. So I'll show that to you by a very, very vague Landau's argument next time. Questions?
How does it depend on Q1 and Q2? If they're already solved completely from the Lagrangian?
Yeah.
Like the only free parameters are Q1 and D2, it looks like.
Yeah, but you're also fixing, so you consider your boundary value data, right? So you're saying at T1, I'm at Q1, at T2, I'm at Q2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so implicitly or whatever it is, it depends on these two as well.
I think, in the beginning, we were starting to say that, okay, the Hamiltonian is going to be a function in the cotangent bundle, right? So if we are in a manifold, what makes these canonical transformations special? Because they are just coordinate transformations, right?
Yeah, well, thanks. Yes. You will see. You will see. Okay. So wait with that question. It will be answered in two lectures. Once we discuss the geometric thing, it will be obvious.
Yeah, because here it's not clear what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. So wait with that question. And if it's not clear after we discuss this, then ask again. Okay, thanks. Other questions? Yeah?
And I'm just naively thinking, when we are changing the coordinate, can the T also be changed?
Not here. so I just defined the canonical transformation as I'm just changing Q and P. You could be changing T as well, I think, but that's certainly not what I'm doing here. Yeah. But yeah.
In any other area?
Okay, I don't know if it's useful. I don't know. Other questions?
See, the generating function, you said it should be like a function of like either P and Q or Q and Q or whatever, but it's a function.
It's a very good question. So you can think of, so T0, so T1 is like the initial time. Let's forget about that. So then Q1, what it is, it's an initial position. Okay, so in some sense, you will be understanding the initial position as the old coordinate, as you are describing the system, how it looked like in the coordinate Q1. Okay, and then what Q2 is and what T is, so let me write it like this. So I'll have Q0, and then I'll have Q, and then I'll have T. Okay, so then this is my initial thing, but it's my initial coordinate, is the old coordinate. The Q is the new coordinate describing the thing, so this is the new one, and then T. And so T0 is sort of like just a choice of initial time. So really, indeed, you can write it like the old, the new, and the time. Okay.
What trajectory is function evaluated along, is it the classical trajectory or?
So what you have to do really, you will do it explicitly, don't worry. So but what you have to do is really, you have to solve the equations of motion. You have to write down the equations of motion. For example, I have motion of free particle. So I know that the Q is just A times BT. It's a linear motion. Okay. So now you have to write, so A and B are integration constants. But you have to write them in terms of the boundary value data. So you have to write them in terms of whatever the T1, T2, Q1, and Q2. So these are just constants. So it's not surprising that I can write A and B in terms of Q1, Q2, and whatever. Yeah. So now I have Q as a function of all these things. So now I plug it into the Lagrangian.
Okay.
I calculate whatever that Lagrangian is. I integrate it over time from T1 to T2.
Yeah.
And I get something which depends on all these quantities. And that's what Hamilton's function is.
Okay.